my pleasure to announce the second keynote presentation. As you can see the title there on Fundamental Physics at the LHC. We're very, very fortunate to have Natalia Toro, a faculty member here at Perimeter Institute, giving that. She's originally from Colorado in the US and did her graduate studies at Harvard University, before taking a position at Stanford, I believe, and then coming here. She is very much involved in collaborating with people at the LHC and the LHC experiment. Her research is related to investigating physics beyond the standard model, includes dark matter, other particles, the hierarchy problem, and works very closely with a lot of experiments and experimentalists in terms of collaboration. I'm sure she'll tell you a little bit about her research, and I'm sure also very, very excited to hear a bit about the Higgs. Natalia also, you may know, one of the stars of Perimeter Institute's remodeling particle physics video, so taking photographs afterwards. but I'm going to hand over to Natalia.
Well, thanks to all of you for your enthusiasm, to Damien for the invitation. This is really this is an absolutely, great time to be giving a talk about particle physics in the Large Hadron Collider. I'm sure most of you have seen pictures like this of what a collision event at the Large Hadron Collider looks like, and the announcements just last week about the discovery of a Higgs-like particle. So we'll get to that in about the third part of this talk. Before that, I want to give you just a little bit of context on why we actually are so obsessed with particles. I mean, it seems like sort of a strange thing once you've understood what the building blocks of matter are to keep being obsessed with particles. And I'll try to explain to you why that is, and then how we do it with a little bit of the history and how the Large Hadron Collider and its experiments work. A lot of that, I think, you already saw in the remodeling particle physics workshop thing. I don't know what to call it. And and finally, as I said, look into the Higgs discovery a little bit more. Why is the Higgs particle and the Higgs field that I'm sure you've all heard is related to it so important? How do you actually look for it? Why do we think we've probably, that not we, not me, but the LHC experiments have probably found really solid evidence for it? And then finally, in the last two or three slides, I'll talk about things a little closer to my own research, looking beyond the Higgs, at what other new surprises could be out there for us to discover. So why do we care about particles? Why are we obsessed with them? Well, simply speaking, it's just because everything that we've seen in the universe can be viewed as part of a quantum theory of particles that interact with each other. Nothing else, just particles. And this word accommodated may seem a little sly to you. I say that because we don't know answers to a lot of things. We still don't know why these particular particles are the ones in the theory, why there's a top quark, why there's three kinds of lepton, the electron, the muon, and the tau, and not two, not four, not one. We don't know why the theory is described by particles at all. Maybe there's deeper answers to that kind of question. And in many cases, a couple of quick cases, we don't really know for sure how these particles interact or what they are. But we do know, it's not that we have no theories of particles that explain the phenomena. It's that we have too many theories of particles that explain the observed phenomena, and we haven't found a way to distinguish them yet. Now, the other sort of sly thing here is, well, the word particle. You might already suspect that if I can make a statement as bold as this, what I mean by particle is, very different from what most of us mean colloquially by particle. It's not just something as simple as a grain of sand. It's really something a lot more intricate and more interesting. So usually, when I'm giving a talk like this, I will try to just go through the sort of the bestiary of particles and what each one does. There are quarks, they live inside of the proton, up and then down quarks, and then there's the electron. And then there's all the neutrino, their heavier partners, et cetera. Go through the bestiary. I think you've all probably seen the bestiary once or twice before, so I want to try to do something different and actually try to explain what this notion of a particle is that's so different between a particle physicist and the colloquial meaning of the word. What do I mean by particle when I use it, when I say that everything is described by particles? And of course, this top chunk of the bestiary, all of the kinds of matter, this is totally analogous to a periodic table. This is the stuff that we've observed in the universe. And we've been classifying the stuff that we see for a long time. Everything else gets a little deeper. Antimatter, the fact that there's other kinds of stuff that's mathematically related to this stuff, but different, opposite charge, but just tied together by the math of describing a particle, that's your first hint that there's something really kind of new and different about what I mean by the word particle. And then these particles associated with the forces. So the photon, a particle associated with electromagnetic forces and with light. The gluon, a particle associated with the strong forces. And the W and the Z particles associated with the weak forces. Those are a sign, again, of something really different going on with these particles. And before I get to the Higgs, and I won't get to gravity much at all and to dark matter only a little bit, everything to the left of my hockey to the left from your side of my hockey you're right. No, you're left. Everything to the left of the hockey stick, sorry. is particles that we've pretty much seen, understood. We feel like we know what's going on pretty well. To the right, things that, at least up until as of July 3rd of this year, we didn't have a firm observational confirmation of. We just think there's something like them in the theory for a variety of reasons. We know there's a force of gravity. We haven't seen the particle. We've never seen gravitational waves yet, and so on. So these are our basic building blocks. These are the parts that I'd say we're still trying to get the full experimental confirmation of, even though the classical aspects of gravity we've seen, we understand quite well. So what is it that makes this special? And I'll focus again on these four forces here, and the matter over here, and the antimatter. How is the way we think about these particles different from the way you think about a speck of dust? And how the hell can a particle be responsible for a force? Okay, so to get to that second point, which is one way of understanding the main key difference here, we have to go to quantum mechanics and the uncertainty principle. So Werner Heisenberg was the first one to point this out, that really you can never know, even with an infinitely precise machine, there's just an intrinsic ambiguity in either the momentum or the position of a particle, and either the energy or the time. This ambiguity leads to a sort of ambiguity in what a particle, what a given state, so a configuration of matter really is. Okay, you can never be sure, if I have an electron traveling along, I can never be sure whether this is really just an electron or whether it's actually accompanied by other particles that it can interact with. So the analogy I like to use for this is that it's a lot like borrowing money from a bank. Okay, so energy is conserved, and what I mean by money is energy. Energy is conserved, but just like you can take out a loan from a bank, that doesn't give you more money, but it does give you more buying power, right? As long as you pay it back later, you can do things with the extra cash that you couldn't have done otherwise. But in the end, the amount of money, total money you have, cash minus debts, that's staying the same, right? And you always have to give it back at the end. Well, quantum mechanics lets you borrow energy to produce states for some limited period of time that you don't actually have the energy to really produce. You just have to give that energy back at the end. So I've tried to draw this schematically here. My electron's going along, it has some energy. Now, it takes more energy in order to actually emit a photon. It doesn't have that energy, but it can borrow it, as long as it gives the photon back. And it's related to the uncertainty principle. I know you can barely read this little scribble at the bottom, that the amount of time I can borrow a photon for is basically proportional to the inverse of that photon's energy. The photon's just a particle of light. Actually, this is happening all the time. Every electron in the world is doing this, and it's not just doing it once. It's got tons of these little, what we call virtual photons, floating around, you know, in its inside of what it is. Now, how does this relate to forces? Well, most of the time, an electron will just, you know, emit its virtual photons and absorb its own virtual photons. But sometimes, it can actually exchange it with another particle. So if there's a proton coming around, the electron can borrow energy to produce a photon. Instead of the electron reabsorbing it itself, the proton will absorb that same photon. And in that case, energy is still conserved. The total energy in, and momentum too, the total energy in between the electron and the proton is the same as the total energy coming out. But some of it's been exchanged between the electron and the proton. So the quantum bank is happy, and this is a perfectly good state that you can go out in. And what's happened is that the proton has just electromagnetically scattered off the electron, or vice versa. And in the picture of the world of electrodynamics that Feynman pioneered, this is what's really happening. This is one way of understanding how you get an electric force between an electron and a proton, is that each one is continually absorbing and emitting these virtual photons. And some of the time, the photon absorbed by one will be emitted by the other. Photon emitted by one will be absorbed by the other. That exchange, that crosstalk, is where the force comes from. Now, that's all well and good, but you all know a very different way of thinking about where electric forces come from, right? All of the classical electromagnetism, Maxwell's equations, seen it on many t-shirts, and there's no quantum mechanics here. We just say that a proton has an electric field. There are some field lines. And the electron feels those field lines, and so that'll deflect its motion away from a straight line. Totally classical, no quantum mechanics, no virtual particles, nothing like that. So these are two equivalent ways of describing the same effect, the scattering. And it turns out they're very closely related. If you try to take Maxwell's equations, which has electromagnetic fields, and also electromagnetic waves, that's just light. You try to meld that into a quantum mechanical theory. The only way to do that is that there is inevitably a consequence that there is a smallest wave of light. We can call that a particle of light or a photon. Goes the other way too, by the way. Anytime you talk about particles, you want to build a quantum theory of particles where in some sense things that interact are close to each other, not, you know, randomly far away, but everything happens close to each other. This leads you pretty much inevitably to a theory of fields. And in both cases, when you add special relativity into the mix, you also get antiparticles. So actually, these two ways of thinking about what's happening, just an electron and a proton, either big classical electric fields that make the other guy scatter, or this exchange of virtual quantum particles. These are equivalent ways of looking at the world. To get the classical picture, you need to consider not just one photon being exchanged, but all possible combinations of photons. So it's a much more complex calculation over here, but these are really equivalent ways of viewing it. The one on the left obviously continues to thinking about more inherently quantum mechanical processes as well. Now, this new way of picturing things in terms of exchanging particles gives us a way of understanding why the weak interactions are weak. So electromagnetism, if we understand that as the exchange of photons, they have no mass. So that means that their energy can go down as low as you want. And remember I said that the distance over which these exchanges happen is proportional to 1 over the photon energy. So the smaller that energy gets, the larger the distance over which it can transmit a force. Now, the weak force is mediated by the exchange of these W and Z particles. And they're heavy. They have 100 times the mass of the proton. So that means that their smallest energy is mc squared. That's big compared to most distances. So So they only go out a little ways before they have to get reabsorbed. That means that the only way you get that, if you have a proton and say a neutrino is a particle that only interacts with the weak force, if they're relatively far away, they just don't talk to each other. Each one of them is emitting and absorbing Z particles, but they can't crosstalk because they can't travel far enough. It's only when they get really close, when the distance is small compared to Planck's constant h over the mass of the Z times the speed of light, that's called the Compton wavelength of the Z particle. It's only at these small distances that this weak force, scattering by exchanging Z particles or W particles, is really effective. And this distance, just to give you an idea, it's about a hundredth the size of a proton, 10 to the minus 18 meters. So most collisions that you'd expect to happen in the world are going to be at much larger distances than this. And this is why we call it weak. Actually, if you get in that close, once you're talking about a really close collision like that, the weak force is stronger than electromagnetism. It's about 5 times stronger for a really close collision. But if I just shoot a neutrino at something, it's probably not going to get that close, and I won't really see much interaction at all. This is, by the way, why neutrino detectors have to be so darn big. It's because most neutrinos are just going to sail past. Even if you have a ton of material, most of the neutrinos will just sail past. And you need a huge bulk to increase the odds that one of these very near collisions will happen. Here you can see a big boat inside. This is actually a layer of water, Super Kamiokande detector in Japan. And this is the snow detector in Sudbury. This whole area ends up being filled with water when they run the experiment. So really huge devices to measure neutrinos. This is also part of the reason we need accelerators. Because let's say we wanted to study the weak interactions. I mean, to really understand the interaction, you have to know how it interacts with all kinds of particles, not just neutrinos. It's like if we knew that electrons had charge minus one, but we didn't know anything about the proton's electric charge. We wouldn't really know much about electromagnetism. How are you going to study the weak interactions of a particle that most of the time interacts through some other interaction, like the electron? It's pretty hard. In order to do that, you need to find a way to probe these really small distances where the weak interactions actually matter. And like I said, that's 1/100th the size of a proton. In order to access that, we use the uncertainty principle again. Short distances mean high momenta. So by going to really high momentum collisions, we get a handle on, say, weak interactions and possibly any other new interactions we might find at very short distances. And there's just no way to probe that stuff on a tabletop because pretty much electromagnetism dominates over all the new and wonderful things that could be there. So where are we? All the observed phenomena, all the matter and the forces can be incorporated in a quantum theory of these sort of weird quantum mechanical particles, or equivalently a quantum theory of fields. The particles that are massless, like photons, they mediate long-range forces. Heavy particles can also mediate forces, but they're over really short distances, and we need high-energy accelerators to study them. Now, how did we get here? Just a brief bit of history that'll sort of build to the LHC. So, in my opinion, these 19th century devices are the first particle accelerators. They didn't know it at the time. They had no idea what this little green glow inside of the tube was. Faraday actually invented it just to study the passage of electricity through gases. And then over time, people's vacuum technology got better. And eventually, they figured out what these devices actually were. So J.J. Thomson was the one that really showed that there was a new particle responsible for that green ray of light. Here's a picture of him in the laboratory and the schematics from his paper. What you can see here, what he's doing is applying lots of different electric and magnetic fields on the tube to see what they do. And this is the other sense in which this is the first particle accelerator, is it really works exactly the same way, on exactly the same principles of accelerating particles as the LHC. So how does it work? Well, Electric forces, they'll accelerate a charged particle. Negative charges get accelerated towards a positive potential and vice versa. Magnetic forces, they never accelerate a particle forward, but they bend particles. And the amount of bending is inversely proportional to the momentum. And opposite directions for both of these if the charge is reversed. So with those ingredients, turns out the electric field was what was driving the electrons in Thomson's tube. The magnetic field was what he used to show that these were really particles, measure the ratio of their charge to their mass by actually measuring them move. Now, the second discovery I'll highlight that's also key to the way we use particle accelerators today is antimatter. I alluded to it earlier that they're mathematically related to the ordinary matter particles. And when Dirac first predicted a positron in trying to understand how electricity, the quantum theory of electromagnetism, so he had electrons and photons. His theory predicted a positron. And this was the greatest embarrassment in the world at the time. Predicting a particle that nobody had seen was just heresy. And then, a year or two later, Anderson found the particle. So Dirac felt much better. And this was really a momentous breakthrough for science, because the existence of this antiparticle, the positron, what it guarantees is that any particle can be created or destroyed, right? So the general rule is that everything that can happen, that which is not forbidden, is mandatory, okay? Now, what's forbidden? Things that violate conservation laws, things that violate conservation of energy, conservation of charge, conservation of momentum, those can't happen. But anything that's permitted by those conservation laws can happen. What an antiparticle does is it lets you create an electron, because you can create a pair, electron and positron, and together they have zero charge. So this means if you collide an electron and a positron together, they'll annihilate. You lose both of them, and they can annihilate into, say, a pair of photons. If you collide anything else together, you can produce an electron and a positron. And you do need energy to do that. So one way of thinking about that, perhaps the simplest example of this creation in a familiar context, is if we just think about the example I was mentioning earlier, a proton scattering off an electron. Now, most of the time, their potential energy, it goes like the charge squared over the distance, and that's pretty small compared to the mass of an electron. But if you get in really, really close, then this potential energy is actually bigger than the mass energy, mc squared, for an electron, or even for two electrons, an electron and a positron. So that means there's enough energy just stored in the electric potential of the proton and the electron when they get really close that you could actually produce. New particles out of it. And the sort of quantum version of that is shown here, that you borrow some energy, electron borrows some energy from the quantum bank, proton does too, and then these two photons just annihilate into an electron and a positron. And now the energy is happy again. The total energy is happy, but it's not just shared between these two particles, it's shared between four. Now, all of these things just happen some fraction of the time, and you can never predict when. There's another vivid example that I want to show you of particle creation. Let me see if I can, Here's the picture. All of the pictures you see from the LHC, unless they've been doctored, sometimes they clean them up to show the parts that are interesting, will have this kind of a spray of lines in them. All over the place. What are those? Those are actually a bunch of particles where the strong interaction converted energy into new particles. And the way to think about what's going on there is that the proton is really tightly bound. This is, say, one of the colliding protons is really tightly bound by the strong force. Two up quarks and a down quark. If there's a force that pulls, say, one of those up quarks far away, then as it does, there's still a strong binding energy between the up quark and these guys. That energy grows and grows and grows. The farther this up quark gets away, the more it grows. And actually, this is a special thing about the strong interactions compared to electromagnetic. Electromagnetic energy, once you get far enough away, it's not really changing anymore. changing much anymore. Just approaches zero. Strong energy keeps growing and growing. It's just proportional to distance. So that means eventually you're gonna guaranteed to get far enough away that you have the energy to, bam, produce two more particles. And now you've got a strong bound state of an up quark and an anti-up quark. This is what we call a pion. And this guy can relax back into the proton. But that keeps happening, often many times, as that up quark is getting pulled away by some other really dramatic impact. And so you get a whole spray of these particles from each collision. So it happens whether we like it or not. And of course, it was only a matter of time before, not very long time, before people started trying to put it into practice to actually search for new matter by trying to produce it, since anything can be produced, combining the electric and the magnetic force, just the same way as Thomson. Magnetic field to bend the particles, keep them all in place, and an electric field to accelerate them up to high energies and see what comes out when you smash them together. So this is the first cyclotron, quite small, actually predates the positron discovery, but was unprecedented for its time. The Spear Accelerator near San Francisco, which discovered a lot of the particles in our modern bestiary. The Tevatron in Chicago, which was operating until, I believe, last year, and discovered the top quark. And it's the second highest energy collider that's ever been achieved in the world. And finally, in Geneva, the LHC. Same exact principles, as you'll see in a minute. So these are the magnets of the LHC. They bend the particles around. Right around here on the picture, that's the only place that acceleration is happening. These are the little, these are actually the place where the electric field, and there's a rapidly oscillating electric field, have gotten a lot more sophisticated since, Thomson, it was basically a battery. And you can't build a battery big enough to work for the LHC. Just have an oscillating electric field that's always pushing forward, never backwards, on the protons. And it has to be very clever because it has to push forward on protons that are going this way and forward on protons that are going the opposite way so that you have two beams in the same ring. Much larger scale, much more complex, but the same underlying principle. Accelerate with electric fields and bend with magnetic fields to keep them in a circle. Actually, the reason the LHC is as big as it is just that it has the highest energy protons in the world. And at this energy, each of these magnets, even though these are top-of-the-line magnets, can only bend the protons by about 7 centimeters. So you string that end to end, and you need a 26-kilometer-long tunnel before it closes in on itself. So the LHC, you might say, is as small as it possibly can be with our current magnet technology to get the protons to close the circle. And you know, if they develop reliable technology to build bigger magnets, stronger magnets, then we'll be able to go up to twice the energy that we can right now, maybe even more than that. So doubling of the energy is planned for the near future, next couple of years. Anything beyond that really requires new magnet R&D. Now, that's great. Now we have protons going around in a circle, not hitting each other. Very exciting. But there's four points along the ring where collisions do happen. And the two that I'll focus on are 0.5 and 0.1. These are where the CMS and ATLAS detectors are, and they're looking for the collisions that are spectacular. So up at the top, this is a little picture of the CMS detector. You can barely see a person down here, a little beam that all those 4 TeV protons are going through. And then there's another set of protons going the opposite way. And they're rearranged right in front of the detector so that they'll actually smash into each other, these two bunches, in the middle of the detector. Now, by the way, most of the protons in those bunches are still going to be far enough away that they just sail past each other. It's just a select few that'll interact, and that's what you see, is the product of those interactions. So this thing is a many-layered camera, each layer measuring different properties of the particles. Here's a schematic, and you can kind of see that, you know, some each type of particle represented by a different kind of line interacts differently. So this red one here is an electron, and it'll leave a track in this inner layer, which is called a silicon tracker. Basically, a bunch of silicon detectors that keep track of every time a charged particle hits it. They can measure very precisely where it hit. And then it stops and deposits all of its energy in this layer, which is called a calorimeter, because it's basically measuring heat, or the total energy of that electron as it stops. And this is another kind of calorimeter layer that's used to measure the total energy of particles that have that are hadrons, made up of quarks. And then out here, there's a layer that measures muons, because they're the only things that'll make it through these two and are charged, and so they'll interact here. Now, throughout this, you see the lines, the tracks bending, and that's once again because of magnetic fields. It's thanks to those magnetic fields that you can measure not only the energies of particles in here, but also their momenta by just measuring how the tracks curve. This is that silicon layer in the center. Love it, so I have to show pictures. These are some pictures of the ATLAS detector being assembled. And you can't actually see any parts of the detector here, just these big coils for their magnetic field. So the most dramatic part of the detector is really not the material itself, but its magnetic field. Whoa. Now, what do we do with these things? Most of the particles we want to study actually decay almost instantly. That which is not prohibited is mandatory. And so if a particle can decay, it will do so, in most cases, very, very quickly. So the detectors are taking pictures of just the final products of this decay using all of the techniques that I mentioned. And you can tell the difference when you have an electron, when you have a photon, based on which parts of the detector, which of these layers, they actually interact in. And then measure their energy, angles, and things like that. This is an example of an event with two muon, well, actually a muon and an anti-muon, that make it into this farthest stretch of the detector at CMS, probably produced by a Z particle that can decay into them. And this is another picture. This, again, probably a Z particle decaying differently into an electron and a positron. And what you see here, these towers are a way of presenting graphically just the total energy that was measured in that area by this chunk of the detector that I called a calorimeter earlier. Now, it's important to remember that everything that's allowed will happen some of the time, which also means that nothing ever happens all of the time, and we can't predict when a particular kind of collision event is going to happen. So we can't predict when a Z is produced. We can't predict how it will decay. There's different ways that it can decay. All we can do is calculate the probabilities of each type of decay and compare that with the fraction of events where it actually happens. So we're always looking at an ensemble of events in order to try to learn anything. And you'll see that very much when we look at the Higgs. Because this, I've been saying that this is probably a Z, that was probably a Z decay, right? But we can never be sure, because there's other kinds of things that can mimic this same signal. But when you look at an ensemble of events, you'll see in a minute how new particles show up in that ensemble. All right, so what's it good for? I'm about to get to the discovery of the Higgs, but first I want to explain a little bit about why it matters, in part because this is something that's you know, so easy to get wrong. I mean, we all hear the Higgs. It's responsible for the origin of mass. Mass is what makes us gravitate, so what's the relation of the Higgs to gravity, right? That is the natural set of questions to ask. And it turns out that it's the wrong set of questions, because that setup, the Higgs has to do with mass, isn't completely right. So let me back up the story just a little bit. Let's just try to say all of these particles have mass. End of story. It doesn't need to come from a Higgs. I can just write down a mass. Say the W has a mass. It's 82 gigaelectron volts. What's wrong with that theory? Why do I need a Higgs? Well, the problem is that if I have a theory where a W has a mass, and I calculate how two W particles scatter. What's the probability that they will interact rather than just going through each other? When I calculate that probability, I get a number bigger than one. So that's not good. This theory must be, you know, nonsense or more charitably incomplete. I have to add something to it that makes the probability smaller than one, like all good probabilities are. And the thing that can do that is adding a new force that changes how the W's interact. This new force has to be associated with a new particle. Call that the Higgs particle. The coupling, in order to solve this problem, though, you can't just add any new force and expect it to solve the problem. At high enough energies, there will still be a mathematical inconsistency where the probability of two W's scattering off each other is bigger than one, unless the coupling of the Higgs to the W is precisely related to the W's mass. And in fact, I can go on and do the same thought experiment where instead of two W's colliding, I have a W and a top quark colliding. And I'll find that this Higgs also needs to couple to the top quark. That coupling needs to be exactly proportional to the top quark's mass. So now I'm left that this theory can be consistent if I add a new particle, which I call the Higgs, and the crazy assumption that the Higgs coupling to the W, to the top, to the electron, to every one of the fundamental particles on my slide is proportional to that fundamental particle's mass. That is a pretty absurd hypothesis to swallow, unless you can explain why the two are connected by some kind of causal relationship, right? Unless you can say the Higgs interaction with the particle causes its mass, or maybe the mass causes the interaction with the Higgs. Second one doesn't work too well, so let's go with the first. How can the interaction with a Higgs particle cause a particle mass? Well, without really getting into it, because it's actually quite technical, just like electric fields can accelerate particles, right? And that's based on how the photon couples to the electron or to whatever charged particle. A Higgs field, the way it couples, actually gives a particle more inertia. So if I just write down, so if there's a Higgs field in all of space, then naturally every particle would get a correction to its mass that's proportional to that Higgs field. So now, that tells me that I can build a theory of the universe where all of the fundamental particles, electron, muon, WZ, gluon, photon, they're all massless at the beginning. But they get mass because of a Higgs field that fills all of space. Okay, so this is a lot of you are probably thinking, yeah, really? You want me to believe that? And, you know, that's why it was so important to actually discover this Higgs particle and show that we weren't all on something. because this is really a pretty bold hypothesis, that the only way this theory can make sense is if I add a new particle whose couplings are precisely proportional to everybody else's mass. But if you just follow the theory, take it seriously, it had worked many times before, you were led inevitably to that prediction. So that's the role of this. To summarize, the role of the Higgs is just that to make a consistent theory, it has to give mass. It has to have couplings proportional to the mass of every one of these particles, okay, which is zero for these guys, not zero for them, not zero for any of the matter. And we actually still don't really know how it couples to the neutrinos, but that's a detail. And that actually the right interpretation is probably that these particles start out massless and they get a mass from a Higgs field that's filling up all of space. Now, that's different from, so mass gravitates. Mass induces a gravitational force. Energy also induces a gravitational force, E equals mc squared. The Higgs induces mass. So the relationships are different. It's also true that if you look at, say, yourself or me, most of our mass has nothing to do with the Higgs. Most of our mass actually comes, and most of the mass of protons and neutrons inside of us, isn't coming from the Higgs. It's coming directly from the energy that it takes to put three quarks together, close together into a proton. And that energy, through E equals mc squared, that makes up 99% of the proton's mass, 99% of your mass and mine. So most of our mass has nothing to do with the Higgs. But should be clear from everything I've said that the Higgs is still vitally important. Because now, without a Higgs field, if you accept this picture that I just told you, that all the electron's mass, the W mass, comes from a Higgs, without a Higgs field, the electron couldn't, in any consistent theory, have a mass. Without an electron mass, atoms wouldn't be stable. That would be bad. For us, for anything. The W and the Z bosons would be actually not technically massless, but that's a detail. They'd be very close to massless. So radioactive decays would be much, much faster. The proton would also, turns out, be heavier than the neutron. So that instead of the neutron decaying into the proton, which that's fine, that still allows us to make lots of chemical elements, the proton would decay into the neutron, and I mean, the universe would be a pretty boring field of neutrons. So it's well worth our time to really understand how this field works. And the only way to get a handle on it, because this is a really short distance effect, aside from the mass, which we've already seen, we want to test this whole theory of where the mass came from, we need to look for the Higgs particle. The key to doing that is this sort of bizarre assumption that I started with, that its couplings to all these fundamental particles are proportional to their masses. So that tells us what it interacts with, how to look at for it. The problem is that the particles of the strongest Higgs charges, the heavy ones, things like the top, the W and the Z, they basically decay instantly. The up and down quarks inside of a proton, the electron, these are light particles with really tiny, wimpy Higgs charges. So they're not a good way to produce Higgs particles. So wouldn't it be great if we had a top collider? If we had a top anti-top collider, then bam, we'd collide two tops together, a top and an anti-top together. And because they have strong Higgs charges, a good fraction of the time you'd produce a Higgs. Or you'd produce a Higgs and something else. Well, we have a quantum top collider. So this goes back to this whole idea of borrowing energy. We can borrow energy to make a pair of tops. And then that pair of tops will cycle back and create our Higgs for us. This is a rare process because it relies on this quantum borrowing kind of thing. But it still happens. Just to give you an idea, whereas we produce 150 W bosons at the LHC every second, this is actually probably an outdated table. These were last year's numbers, and the collision rate at the LHC has increased. So we're probably making like 1,000 a second. You should scale these up, but I'm not sure exactly by what. At least the ratios are right. At that time, last year, 150 W bosons every second, a pair of top quarks maybe every 2 seconds, and a Higgs only 5 of them per minute. That's still a lot of Higgs bosons. Problem is that most of them decay in ways that are actually pretty hard to search for. So I'll just focus on not the most frequent, but the most visible ways that a Higgs particle decays. One is, again, through this quantum borrowing. Sorry, this is hard to see. Through quantum borrowing, you produce W bosons. They're charged, so they can emit photons, light particles. And the Higgs can decay to 2 photons. That's actually extremely rare, about a 1 in 1,000 process. But 1 in 1,000, 5 a minute, eventually you'll get some of them. So we can look for those. Another one, this is more frequent. This is, I think, a 10 or 20% decay mode, that the Higgs will decay basically into 2 Z bosons. Problem is that then in order to see those Z bosons, they have to also decay nicely. Say this one to an electron, say each one to an electron and a positron, or to muons, that's also very easy to see. So once you add in all of those extra factors, this is also comparable to a 1 in 1,000 type of rate. And remember, we only see the end product. So we don't get to see that, oh, this is nice. This is 2 photons that came from a Higgs. We just see 2 photons. And that could have come from a whole bunch of other processes, too. So how do we know that they're from a Higgs? Or how do we know that the 4 leptons are from a Higgs? Well, this is the sort of the main key ingredient of these searches, is we do know that the total mass of this pair of photons is the mass of the Higgs. Now, I think you guys have probably worked through this in the remodeling particle physics, activities, but I'll just remind you what I mean by the total mass of two photons. So really what we're trying to do is work backwards from these photons to get the mass of the Higgs. We know that the energy of the Higgs is related by relativity to the momentum times c squared plus the mass of the Higgs squared. And that means I can just solve that equation for the mass of the Higgs, and it's the square root of the Higgs energy over c squared minus the Higgs momentum squared over c squared. Okay, we still can't see the Higgs energy or the Higgs momentum, but we do know that energy and momentum are conserved. So if we can measure the energy of photon 1 and photon 2, we can measure the momentum in each of these, even though I didn't draw it that way, each of these is a vector of photon 1 and photon 2. We add the vector momenta together, we add the energies together, and that lets us solve for the Higgs energy, the Higgs momentum, and guess, work backwards, what mass of Higgs would have produced that pair of photons. Still don't know they came from a Higgs, but you can say if they came from a Higgs, what mass of Higgs would it have to be? And then you stack them all up into a histogram. So this is one event with two photons at Atlas. There's a photon there on one side of the detector and one on the opposite side. I measure their energies. You don't actually measure the photon's momentum directly, but you know that for each photon, you know which way it's pointing, and you know that for a photon, because it's massless, the energy is just the momentum. The magnitude of the momentum is just proportional to its energy divided by c. And so you have the ingredients to make one point on this histogram. You stack them all up. This is actually a bit of a fancy stacking. And what you'll see is there's a smooth part. This came from all kinds of things, all kinds of other events. They don't line up at a particular mass. They're not associated with the Higgs. And then there's a bump. This bump is what we think is probably a Higgs. So that's it. That is the first piece of evidence. If it's a Higgs, it should show up in other places, like the other decay mode I mentioned, into four leptons. So here's an example of an event not decaying into four electrons, like the one I showed, but the same kind of process, where the Higgs decays into two Z bosons, and each one decays into a muon and an anti-muon. And they calculate the mass in just the same way, except now there's four particles instead of two, 125.2 gigaelectron volts. And when you stack up 2 years worth of them, there's high bins right here, same mass as in the previous plot, right where you'd expect if there was a Higgs. So you combine all of this together, and you get 5 sigma evidence. That means 5 standard deviations, very low probability that that would happen just by a fluke, in favor of a particle that walks and talks like a Higgs. Now, this is a huge success. I mean, we still have to wait and measure the properties more precisely to see if we convince ourselves that it really is a Higgs and that there's nothing funny about its interactions, nothing different from this theory. But we did predict a Higgs particle based on consistency of the quantum theory. And so far, there's a particle matching these predictions showing up in the data. Like, this is a really big confirmation that, sort of preposterous sounding hypothesis, but physicists were nonetheless really convinced of, is right. And it also, because this validates this new explanation for why the W and Z have mass, while photons and gluons don't, it means that it's really putting all the three forces in a confirmed way on the same footing. They really all seem to be coming from the same kind of physics, with small differences, like the fact that the W interacts with a Higgs, and the gluons don't. That kind of small difference in the underlying theory leads to a big difference in how we observe the world, namely that the electromagnetic forces are very important to the world, and weak forces are just this very, very small distance thing. So why do I say there's a puzzle here too? Well, I'll just start out with this line of scales. So each little tick mark here is a factor of 10. This is a log scale of energies increasing to the right, or if you like, distances getting smaller to the right. They're related thanks to the uncertainty principle. So the size of the Earth is over here on the left. The size of a proton's a good way off. The W, Z, and now the Higgs are pretty close by. All the way over here, this here is what we call the Planck length, the scale where gravity gets strong. That means that this is the distance, down here. This is the distance at which, if you could bring two particles really close together, their gravitational potential energy would be comparable to their electromagnetic energy. So this is the maximum energy up to which the Standard Model could make sense. And there's a lot of sort of, you know, tentative reasons. I don't think anybody would bet their life on it. But there's reasons to think that the Standard Model, we certainly think the Standard Model could be consistent up to this energy. Doesn't mean we know it is, but it could be. Let's take that to our logical conclusion. This is a huge range. This is 10 to the 17 order of magnitude spread. Now, the problem is that quantum mechanics corrects the mass. Yeah. Go back to the line. Yeah, so let's look at the bottom first. So this is sort of a backwards logarithm scale. So this says the proton is 1,000 times smaller than the electron, which is 10,000 times smaller than the atom. And so you read that just by each tick mark over is each tick mark to the left, as you move to the right, is getting 1 power of 10 smaller in distance. Or you can also think of that as getting 1 power of 10 higher in energy. So this strong gravity scale, what I mentioned is the highest scale where the theory could possibly be consistent, is 17 powers of 10 higher energy than the mass energy of a proton, of a W or Z. Right. Yeah, the fact that I can show both of these on one axis is the uncertainty principle. So yes. Yeah, so in terms of what you should think of this, like this, well, this is the atom doesn't, and a person, these don't really make sense as energies. These just make sense as lengths,
yeah.
Right? And then at the level of a proton or an electron, you can start thinking about either their size. Once we get down to the fundamental particles, we can start thinking either about their size or about their energy, and those are closely related. Whereas, you know, I only drew the atom and the person and the Earth over here because their energy has, they're not quantum objects. Their energy has no relation at all to their size. But I'm mostly going to be focusing on this top chunk of the graph. And actually making a point that'll probably be very confusing anyway because I still haven't found a clear way of explaining it. The point is, quantum mechanics, in addition to all the other things we talked about, it also actually corrects the mass of any particle. So when we ask what's the mass of an electron that we measure in a lab, we know it actually has two parts, a classical part that you just stick into the theory, and a quantum part that you can calculate. If you knew the theory exactly, you could just calculate that quantum part. So we can calculate, for example, what the quantum part of the electron's mass from electromagnetism, from interactions with electromagnetism, we can calculate what that is. It's proportional to the classical mass. And so this equation works out OK for an electron. Basically, you get m classical times 1 plus a small correction in some sense. Now, when you calculate this classical plus quantum for the Higgs particle, what matters here is that the Higgs is a particle without spin. Sorry, I'm just going to say that. I can't justify it without a lot of math. The Higgs particle, because it, well, actually, I'll try. The fact that the electron, in general, the default assumption, that which is not forbidden is mandatory, is that all quantum corrections to any particle's mass are big. So the quantum mass should be proportional to just the largest mass in your theory. That's the standard baseline expectation in quantum mechanics. Just anytime you have a big scale in your theory, it'll come in and correct the mass of every particle in your theory. Unless it's forbidden. The way it's forbidden for the electron mass is actually that the electron spin is tied to a symmetry of the electron. And because of that symmetry of the electron, it's what's forbidding that quantum mass. So that's still not, I think, clear or believable, but at least it gives you a flavor of what kind of argument it is, and I'll use the same argument again in a minute. So the quantum mass is proportional to the biggest scale in our theory. If the biggest scale in our theory was this strong gravity scale, 17 powers of 10 bigger than the W mass, then how are we ever going to get this sum to be just the W mass? Well, here's one way, is that the quantum part is some 17-digit number, and the classical part just happens to be the same 17-digit number, except in the last decimal place it's different. This is in a unit where 1 is roughly the scale of the W mass. Now, this is one thing that seems crazy to all of us, particle physicists included. The only resolution is that the closer this largest mass scale was to the W mass, the shorter this number would be, and the less absurd a coincidence it would seem. So the way around needing a crazy accident to explain our universe with a small W mass compared to this gravity scale, the only way to do that is if this M largest, this largest scale of validity of the Standard Model, is actually at an energy very close to the W mass. This is, I think, one of the most speculative arguments in fundamental science today. And if it turns out to be vindicated, it'll be a really spectacular achievement, even more so than the Higgs, if this turns out to be right. But our expectation is that there should be new physics that saves the day in the sense that actually the Standard Model is only valid up to some mass. Here, I'll show the line again. Up to some mass here. So this area here, basically, from the electron to this M largest, that's where the Standard Model lives. And up here, there's some improved Standard Model. An improved Standard Model where actually those quantum corrections, there is some kind of symmetry, some deep reason why the W mass in this improved theory isn't corrected. So what could this improved model be? The W particle could be made up of other particles, just like the protons made out of quarks. That's a hypothesis that, for a variety of reasons, doesn't fit too well with the Higgs particle being as close to the W mass as it is. So most people, I think, would say this is looking less likely now that we've found the Higgs and it's at a low mass. Still possible. The other possibility is that there's some special theory where the Higgs is really just a fundamental particle, but the W mass is small for a reason. And remember, this W mass is coming from a field filling all of space. So really what we're talking about is, why is that field that fills all of space not 17 orders of magnitude stronger than it is? And so many of you have probably heard about supersymmetry, and I don't like to spend too much time talking about detailed theories that haven't been confirmed, so I won't talk about supersymmetry. That falls into the second category. A special theory where there's some symmetry reason that the mass of the W particle is small. Now, the one thing that you should definitely take away from this is that all of these arguments suggest, if we understand the theory correctly, that to make sense, there should probably be new particles right above our heads. Something that fix this theoretical problem that, wait, we can't calculate the mass of the W. When we calculate it, it comes out 17 orders of magnitude too big, right? I mean, you know, you grade tests. The students should do dimensional analysis, and if their number's 17 orders of magnitude too big, go back and think about what they did wrong, right? So we're just doing that. We're going back and trying to think about what we did wrong, but we haven't yet done an experiment that actually confirms what we did wrong. Okay, and one of those particles, I'll just close very briefly because I want to leave you guys time for some questions. One of those particles could possibly be connected to the dark matter in the universe, which is matter, and there's another PI activity about this. matter in the galaxies that's clearly causing gravity. So when we weigh the galaxies by measuring how fast stars move about the center, that gives us one estimate of the mass. This is a plot of the velocity. Well, we just count what mass we think there is based on looking at the galaxy made up of stars, so we can guess the mass of those stars. And it's not only too low of a mass, but also a different shape. And so this strongly hints that there is some new kind of matter. There's other evidence as well. Has to be made out of some other kind of particles. We know it's not made up of electrons, protons, etc. We actually have pretty good evidence for that by looking at very early cosmology. But we don't know what kind of new particles. There's many ideas out there. Many of those ideas could be produced at the LHC. It'd be new particles that the LHC can actually produce, maybe through weak interactions. I'll just leave this with a puzzle, because most of the particles that we see at the LHC, we see them because they have electric or strong interactions, and so they interact with the materials in our detector. Dark matter, it's dark precisely because it doesn't have those interactions, so it'll pass straight through the LHC. So the little puzzle I'll leave you with is, how do you infer that there is actually dark matter being produced in a collision at the LHC? And the hint I'll give you for that is that it has to do with conservation of momentum. So we continue looking. The LHC is progressing, accumulating more data spectacularly fast. Any new particles that are seen, there will be a lot of questions we ask. How often is it produced? What is it produced with? How does it decay? We're asking those questions about the Higgs right now. What are the rules and principles that can explain this behavior? If in the case of the Higgs, we have a pretty good guess already, but we're looking for deviations from it. In other cases, could be a ton of surprises. And can they shed light on these problems of scale and of dark matter? Or are they just some new surprising thing? And the physics that's governing these collisions at the LHC is ultimately the physics that governs our lives, the burning of stars, and so on. That's why we want to understand it, because these particles are encoding the rules, well, it's the fabric of the universe. Well, you can ask me what I expect, but Einstein told me not to answer. and the things that we haven't that we don't understand studying these has consistently broadened our understanding, often in ways that we hadn't even anticipated. So I mentioned that when Faraday first invented this tube, he was just trying to study electricity and gases, had no idea that there were particles being produced inside and that that would be a watershed for physics. So hopefully there will be more surprises in the future. We have a lot of reasons to think that there are interesting possibilities that could be explored at the LHC, and hopefully we'll have more to say later.
I had two quick questions. From the Feynman diagrams, it looks like the Higgs charge is plus 2e. Is that correct?
Which diagrams? It's actually
way,
zero.
Way back. It was a decay, and it looked like if the 2z particles coming off, then the charge coming in.
I might have actually drawn something wrong. So, for example, in this one, so the z is neutral. So this is charge zero, and then here I have a W plus and a W minus.
That's a minus. I couldn't see it. Was
that's
a minus there.
Fair.
And the other question, which I suppose everybody asks, is where does the Higgs get its mass from?
So I mentioned that that in a theory you could just write down a mass for most particles. You could just put it in by hand. The Higgs is one of such. The W and Z, the electron, turn out not to be such particles when you put it in by hand. You start running into inconsistencies at high energies. But the default thing is the Higgs gets its mass basically put in by hand, plus these quantum corrections. So that's a question that in some sense doesn't need to have an answer. Mass doesn't need to come from anywhere, except in special cases, which all of the particles we knew of before the Higgs are such special cases. So that's why it's a little bit confusing. It's actually a special case that particles need to have mass from somewhere. Yeah.
Just out of curiosity, I love the disclaimer Higgs-like particle. It seems like from this exact slide I was going to ask you to go back to was that we're using all what we know about the Higgs to detect it. So how are we going to test if it has any other Higgs-like properties? Have you tested Higgs, I guess?
Right. So that's a good question. There's a lot of things that we're doing. One is looking at the rates of these different decays and also other decays that we can measure. Right. So we can calculate the probability that a Higgs would decay this way, probability that it would decay that way. And then simplest thing is just to look at the ratio of those probabilities, compare it to the ratio of how many events we actually see at each type. Right now, that number is actually a little high, but it's only about 2 sigma. So, you know, we're not sure whether to be excited about it or whether it'll go away. But that's an example. And if that's a little high, then if more data comes in, there will be a lot more data this year, and that number stays high, that ratio, then that's a sign that this may still be very much related to the Higgs mechanism that I mentioned, but it's not as simple as one Higgs particle. Other things that people want to do are actually measure, there's a way to measure the spin of a particle that you're producing. If it's a Higgs particle, that spin should be zero. So they'll want to measure that basically by looking at more detailed properties, how often these photons are produced sort of forward along the direction of the beam compared to being perpendicular to the beam. That kind of thing tells you about the spin. And finally, the absolute rate at which it's produced. Is that like the Higgs? So right now, we have huge error bars on all of these things. We've just barely discovered the particle, and there's a lot of uncertainty in what the rates for these different processes are. But if the experiments can, which they will, narrow down those uncertainties a lot by getting more data, then we'll get more and more confident that this is a Higgs particle. Yeah.
I have a lot of questions, but I don't even know how to ask. So if you had someone come up to you, a newspaper reporter or a student, who said, so what is the Higgs and why is it important? Is there a way to kind of encapsulate that into a correct statement or statements? Does that make sense?
Yeah. Well, so I would say, probably if I had one sentence, I would say that the Higgs particle is important because it's related to a field that we think must be responsible for all the masses of the fundamental particles. Okay, and this discovery of the particle is confirming this view of where the masses come from, right? So it's confirming the theory. And I mean, to the extent that a theory can ever be confirmed, which as you know theory is never completely confirmed. But it's a confirmation of the predictions of that theory, that actually the masses of all the fundamental particles come from this field permeating all of space. Now, I know that's not very simple, and I'm still working on a better answer. But I mean, the other aspect to it is that as we understand it, if you believe the theory at face value, then what the Higgs field does is clearly very important. It makes, because it does give the particle, in this theory, it does give up the particle's masses, all the fundamental particles. It makes atoms possible. It makes the periodic table possible. So really, the Higgs particle, maybe this is what I should say, the Higgs particle makes our whole view of where the periodic table comes from mathematically consistent. Without the particle, our theory, with all its great predictions, would just at some fundamental level not make sense.
Yeah, so it would almost be in contrast. If the LHC showed that it didn't exist, then it would be a catastrophic demise of our model.
Right. Well, I mean, I'm sure we could think of a 10 ways out of it, but each one of them would be surprising and would demand more tests of its own. Yeah. So it would be a hugely significant change in our worldview. In a sense, this is something, I mean, the Higgs particle has been predicted for 50 years. We've sort of all all of us who actually know about it have sort of gotten used to the fact that it probably exists, and now we discover it. And you know, it's what we had been expecting all along. Everybody would have preferred a surprise. No, these things I was mentioning, the small surprises, maybe the photon rate is too high. That kind of thing is still, you know, very possible, would be very exciting too. But it is, I mean, it is the discovery of something that has already been predicted for a while.
The dark matter that you mentioned before that seems to permeate a lot of the galaxies to give a rationale for the velocity, rotational velocity. Would one expect it in a solar system, and then would there be a possibility of some perturbations in the orbits that we would be looking for that would say that, because it does interact gravitationally but not electromagnetically, so would we expect to see some effect within even a solar system orbit that could be measured?
So that's a very good question. One thing is that we expect, you know, the fact that the solar system turns into, you know, a disk and then a sun and planets, this very condensed set of dense things, that's very closely tied to the fact that the things that the sun and the earth are made of have electric interactions, and so they radiate off, they cool by radiating off light. Dark matter doesn't interact with light, and that means it can't cool, it can't collapse in. So it ends up being very diffuse, very structureless on the scales of, say, the solar system. And that means the gravitational effects on the solar system are really extremely small. Now, that said, there is the possibility of interesting effects coming from non-gravitational interactions with dark matter. So, for example, it could interact through the weak interactions. If it does, then dark matter, through these weak interactions, can actually, as it will actually not pass straight through the sun, it'll get trapped in the sun, because occasionally some of the dark matter particles will scatter through these weak interactions off of a nucleus or an atom in the sun. And then the dark matter sort of piles up in the center, and it might eventually start annihilating into stuff. So one of the things that the neutrino telescopes look for, not so much SNOLAB, the ones I showed here, but other neutrino telescopes like one at the South Pole that are just looking for really high-energy neutrinos. One of the things that they look for is actually neutrinos that come from dark matter annihilating in the sun. And there's also experiments right at SNOLAB, other experiments other than SNOW, that are looking for the possibility of dark matter interacting with a nucleus right here on Earth in a very, very quiet, clean detector. So there's certainly a lot of possibilities that, depending on the details of what dark matter is, it could have effects in the solar system, but most of those are actually kind of counterintuitively not the gravitational effects. They're non-gravitational effects. That means they're much more speculative than the gravitational effects. The gravitational effects are small just because the dark matter is so spread out.
Yeah. Hi. So I may have misunderstood you, but I understood that at one point you were saying that all the mass of the matter that we see is 99% of that comes from the energy within the quarks, and then, or to keep the quarks together. And then you just said that the significance of the Higgs is that it is responsible for the masses of fundamental particles. Are we talking about that 1%, or the fundamental particles, the other like different particles?
Yeah, that's a good question, and it is confusing. So I'll spend a little bit more time on that. So if you talk about the mass of a quark, the mass of a proton. Go back to what a proton is. It's basically a bag held together by the strong force somewhere back here. Yeah, of up quarks and down quarks. Now these down quarks and up quarks, they have a little bit of mass. That comes from the Higgs, the mass of the individual quarks. Okay? But then there's the mass of the bag. The mass of the bag is actually the main component of the mass of the quark. So let me just talk a little bit about how do we think about the mass of the bag. The bag, I said, is the strong force. You might think, well, that's coming from the mass of the gluon. That's not right either. Really, the mass of the bag is coming from the energy that it takes to keep these quarks close together that really want to go off, just like students at the end of a really long day, right? It takes energy to keep them all in the same place and just paying attention in the classroom. So it takes energy also to keep these quarks close together. And it's that energy that then that to an outside observer just looks like a mass. Okay, that's an energy because you can't get it out of the proton because they are locked together in there. So that energy might as well be a mass. To an outside observer, it looks like a mass. What it's coming from is binding. I mean, it's just like a binding energy of keeping everybody close together, and then the kinetic energy of the things that are bound. You add those together, you get 1 GeV, the mass, roughly, the mass of the neutron, whereas the masses of these quarks are about, a few parts, are around 1%, once all is said and done, 1% of that mass. The back.
Okay, so you mentioned the calorimeters let us know about the energy the particles bring out.
Uh-huh.
And then you mentioned that we can get the momentum, we get the direction from the tracker, right? And then because they're going, you can get the momentum, you get the direction from the tracker, and from the energy you can get the magnitude, right? So we get the energy and momentum.
Right, it's a little different for different particles.
Right.
So but that's the gist of it.
Okay, and then I just getting stuck on the neutron. Or
right.
any neutral particles.
Okay. That's a good question. So there's two types of neutral particles, two classes. One is photons. So what happens when you produce a photon? You're right, it doesn't go through it doesn't interact in the tracker. A photon will still interact in this electromagnetic calorimeter. Electromagnetic calorimeter is basically a bunch of material, and when a high energy photon or electron goes into the material, it just converts into a much larger number of lower energy electrons and photons. It just showers down into a whole huge number of lower energy particles. And you measure the energy of those lower particles. Now, that bunch of energy, that's all the photon does, is it leaves a bunch of energy in that calorimeter. But the calorimeter has lots of little chunks, and they separately measure the energy in each chunk. So you can actually figure out just from the calorimeter what direction the photon was going. Okay. Now, if you had a charged particle, you need to use the tracker to figure out its original direction because the magnetic field's bending it all over the place. And also that gives a much more precise measure of its direction. But one can still do a pretty good job just using where in the calorimeter the photon went. And so that's for photons. For something like a neutron, that wouldn't interact in the electromagnetic calorimeter, but it would in this next guy, the hadronic calorimeter. You do exactly the same thing there.
Yeah. I was looking at those two huge, amazingly long numbers with the one digit. So the mass, I don't remember if this is correct, but the mass of the W is the difference of these two huge numbers. Now, is that... In any way, I'm trying to relate it to something I think I understand a bit. Is that any way related to Feynman's getting rid of this infinities in the early group theory?
They're technically very different infinities. So they are related, but as we've understood the field theory better, it becomes pretty clear that actually Feynman's infinities, you can think of as just coming as coming from basically from the physics at scales you understand. And you can just add and subtract infinity and you get a finite answer that you trust. So people have done calculations with fourth order quantum corrections that one way of writing them would involve infinities, but another way of writing them, you just get actually 12 digits of precision on a finite sensible number. So we've managed to control that type of infinity. And then the type of infinity that's coming that I was bringing up here, it's an infinity that really comes from physics at the highest energy scale in your theory, the physics you understand least. Okay, but it also means that the 12 orders of magnitude would come from the physics I understand least at the very top of the scale. But if there were some new particle somewhere in the middle here, just some random new particle, that would also maybe 7 orders of magnitude out. That would still introduce a 7-digit number And there's no way of predicting what that seven-digit number is unless you know all the properties of the new particle. So it sort of means, you know, there has to be a scale where everything, where either there's nothing new happening, and that just seems crazy because we know something new has to happen around the time that gravity becomes important. Or there's a scale where very special new things happen that make all the corrections from particles heavier than that actually small. So I don't know if that helps. It's a very, very intricate point, a bit mathematical. Yeah.
As we're speaking, is the LHC of capable of producing events in that range of
all the way up? No. So the LHC is capable of going, depending on exactly what type of particle you're looking at. See, the LHC has different effectiveness depending on whether you're talking about producing particles that have strong interactions with weak interactions, or even new force carriers similar to the W and the Z. But basically, the LHC can go 10 times heavier than the WZ and Higgs, maybe 20 or 30 in special cases. They might try to upgrade it. They will try to upgrade it at the end of this year, shut down for a while to double the energy. But either way, we're talking about just, you know, in between 1 and 2 powers of 10 on this scale. So the LHC directly can only get up to here or so.
So obviously, we can't build a machine capable to probe the Planck Atlantic.
Right. And I mean, there's actually sort of deep, if you imagine trying to build a machine that did that, even with, you know, with like far future technology, there's problems that you run into, like just technical problems of how much things would heat up. So we can't directly probe this with accelerators. This is why a lot of people at Perimeter are just trying to think about quantum gravity with their brains, because we have no idea how to get up here with a machine, with an experiment. sort of a great unknown.
Just kind of tying it into the experimental part of things. When you're dealing with the, talking about where these events are, and you're tracking the events in the calorimeters, you're getting your nice little circular histogram. What kind of, are those binned at all, or what kind of resolution does it actually get? I'm just kind of curious.
Yeah, so it depends on the exact, I mean, the exact particles that you're looking at. And it actually varies a little bit depending on where they go in the detector. Like the caps on the ends have a lower resolution than the part in the center. But usually they're binned. So if you look at all of these, at these histograms with the expected Higgs signal, you can see that it's spread, most of it's spread over about 3 bins. And the 1 sigma is probably about 1 bin. Okay, and that bin is 3 GeV. So that gives you an idea of the resolution. It's about a couple of percent on the final masses of the particles.
Okay, I was just talking about the one that's spherical, and you're talking about the 2 photon events on either side.
Yeah, like this one.
It might be back a little bit more. Nope.
This is the one photon, and this is the other.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. So okay. Again, so the average resolution for events with 2 photons is about 1.5. GeV, and you can again see that the width of this blob has nothing to do, in this case, has nothing at all to do with the width of the Higgs. That Higgs peak, if you had a really precise detector, would actually be a little thimble of a line, about 1/1000th the width that we see here. This is all coming from smearing by the detectors. Now, this particular kind of event is a little better, is a really clean event, which probably has a better resolution by like a factor of 2. But the sort of average resolution when you combine all the events is in this neighborhood of 1.5.
I don't mean to push it. I'm just talking about the angular resolution.
Oh, the angular resolution.
The
sorry.
Itself.
Okay.
Sorry.
I'm just going to guess that it's around 1% based on the fact that factors into this, and this is about 1%. I don't remember the exact numbers. for photons. Yeah.
You mentioned with the dark matter detection that it was related to conservation of momentum. I assume that the dark matter would be a bit like neutrinos in that you can really directly detect it. So could you add anything, any details to how they're looking for the dark matter?
Yes, I can. So so I'll just give two examples in the form of Feynman diagrams. Both of these are searches that are actually done. So one thing people do is they look at, let's say you produce dark matter, and in the same interaction, you're also producing something else, say a gluon. Then what you'd get is that the dark matter particles are going to carry some angular momentum one way. You don't see them. But that angular, momentum. The gluon carries momentum the opposite way. You do see it. So the gluon leaves, basically turns into a whole bunch of hadrons, all pointing the same direction, leave a bunch of energy on this side of the detector, nothing else balancing it. This is called a monojet event, because there's this jet of particles coming from the gluon, nothing balancing it. And that's a sign that could be of some invisible particles being produced. And as you say, could be dark matter, could be neutrinos. You really need to look at the distributions and compare it to the distributions you'd expect from neutrinos in order to see. And another thing it could be, in this case, is actually a jet that, for whatever reason, managed to slip through a crack of the detector and you just didn't see it. These are all things that the experimental groups have to worry about. Another thing, this is in the case of theories like supersymmetry, this is what happens, is that often you don't produce the dark matter itself directly, but you'll produce other things and they decay into the dark matter. Same kind of thing, not quite as simple as the last example, but still, all of the visible decay products, whatever they are, maybe jets, will go off. Here in this event, you see they all went off to one side of the detector. And if you add up all of their momenta, you see, well, there had to be some momentum going this way. That could have been caused by the sum of two dark matter particles. And again, you have to compare the distribution. So this is called the missing energy, the magnitude of the momentum that can only be attributed to unseen particles. You have to compare that to what you would have expected. This is the distribution that you would have expected from, this is in a fairly early analysis, from just measuring things wrong, right? If you measure things wrong, you add them up, you won't get zero. That's this little gray part, actually makes up most of the events that you'd expect. And then if you really had neutrinos, that makes up these sort of other colored parts. If you had a particle with dark matter being produced with a pretty high rate, you would have gotten something falling along this purple curve. Now, it looks like a very small difference, but remember, this is like one event per bin over a huge number of bins, so they can actually statistically say with some confidence that this kind of model isn't there. So to date, there's no evidence for either of these ways of looking for dark matter, but these are the kinds of searches that are done.
I was sort of wondering whether, when people ask, but what is this Higgs and why does it matter, that it might help people to realize that this has happened before, that the neutrino was proposed, and then it was, 25, 30 years before they found the neutrino. Okay, maybe that's still too exotic. The neutron was proposed, and
yeah.
It was 15 years or something before the neutrino was detected. And in fact, we can go back to atoms that were proposed, and it got very controversial as to whether they were real things or constructs.
Right.
So this is like the latest version. And so if people understand what atoms are or understand what neutrons are, they're going, oh, this is another thing.
Yeah, I think it's helpful. It's if you go back to any of those examples, that was a case where the theory that justified it was sort of on shaky ground beforehand. This is a case where even the neutrino, I mean, that was proposed because of conservation of energy. Nowadays, we look at that as how could anybody question it? But at the time, people really weren't sure which was more radical, throwing away conservation of energy or adding some new particle that nobody was seeing to your theory. And a lot of people thought, no, there's no neutrino. It's just that energy isn't conserved. This is a case where, by and large, the theory that was running into trouble without the Higgs was so well tested in many other ways, so well understood, that it's harder to imagine, but also, you know, still can happen, but it was really hard to imagine how this could be completely wrong. Okay, so that I think is where the analogy breaks down, is that the level of confidence that scientists had that something had to come in and do this Higgs job was extraordinarily high, much higher than the level of confidence that was held about those particles. Now, in more recent history, the charm quark, the top quark, both of those were predicted before they were seen. The charm, it was actually still a little bit controversial, although a lot of people were very confident. The top quark basically accepted that it would be there, and it was found. But of course, the top quark, it's just, you know, filling in another brick of the same kind as all the bricks we already had in the theory. And the Higgs is exciting also. To me as a physicist, it's exciting because, yes, we predicted it, but it's also a brand new type of ingredient that we've never actually seen in the world before. So, I don't know. I think your analogy is a very good one for explaining why it's a big deal, why it's momentous to somebody who's not a physicist. But I also just wanted to add why this is so different, why this is different to me, and why I'm excited about it. Yeah.
I'm just trying to visualize what it means to be a researcher, not being a newbie to the field. If you're a researcher connected to this project, what's the data look like that you're looking at in your office? Are you getting images of tracks, or are you just getting statistical
right.
data?
Right. So that's a very good question. And actually, one thing that's unusual about particle physics is, although it's starting to happen in other sciences as well, is how segmented most of the experimental analysis is from the theory. So each of these experiments is a 2,000-person collaboration. Those are four, 2 to 4. I don't even remember the numbers these days. Those, you know, order 10,000 people between the two experiments, they're sitting in their offices looking at tracks, writing the programs that actually turn hits in the detector into tracks, and doing the analyses to produce plots like this one, or like the ones I showed you for the Higgs. Now, that is all at the LHC experiments. That is all kept, and at most experiments, kept sort of under, I don't want to say a shroud of secrecy because that makes it sound, you know, Masonic or something. But they're kept private while the experiments are cross-checking their work until they're done and they have, you know, a report that they want to show the rest of us that they actually trust. And that's the level at which I see it, is I see, you know, a talk or a paper where I should have just used the dark matter plot, it was closer, where these plots are presented. So I saw this at 3 a.m. on the 4th of July, along with everybody else, outside, except for those 8,000, and even many of the 8,000 people probably first saw it then, because not everybody's involved in every single analysis. So the things that I do, well, I am actually involved in some other smaller scale experiments, not at the LHC, so I do look at data for those. As far as the physics related to the LHC, the kinds of things that I do is I look at these results coming out, and I think, is there a different way of analyzing the data that might give you access to different kinds of theories? Or I ask questions like, what do these data mean for theories that have been proposed to explain this puzzle of understanding why the W mass is as small as it is? So really taking these, the hard work of thousands of people, as the inputs to, okay, now what's the story, what's the punchline to all of these observations? And then I'm also involved in other kinds of research that are really purely theoretical, where I'm trying to think of new kinds of theories and new kinds of experiments that might eventually be built to test them. So there's a whole range of different kinds of research that people do. I try as much as possible to do a little bit of all of them, but on, you know, on the scale of an experiment like the LHC, most people are either full-time analyzing the data or full-time doing other things with the results and part-time doing other things. Yeah?
Concerning the two photons, DK, you said the number is really off. Do you already have theories trying to explain that, or are you waiting for more data?
Oh, there are many. So there's this archive of physics papers. And I mean, every day there is a paper about different ways that the two photons could be high. All of the theories are, it's a little tight. Like it's most of the theories you try to build actually make the photon rate a little lower. So I think this would add, that's the kind of thing that would actually be really interesting. That, well, because most theories don't predict it, I of course think it's less likely to be true. I think it's more likely that it's a statistical fluke. This is just my opinion. But if it doesn't go away, then I think it'll be especially interesting. Precisely because it's hard to get it from a theory, it'll really point us towards a smaller set of theories that actually do explain it. But yes, there's theories in the literature, you know, every day, new variations, but you know, mostly on a small number of themes that can do that. But then, of course, I mean, there's writing down some new particles that do it, and then there's understanding, you know, what's the structure, why would those new particles be there at all? That second stage is what's at least partly lacking from these theories. Again, speaking from my own opinion only, that if this is true, there's a lot. Then, and one of those models that's been proposed is right, then there's a lot to understand about why the model would actually look that way.
We ran out. Anyway, that was fantastic. We really appreciate the opportunity to ask lots of questions. Thank you very much.